Well, good morning, you old marbleites. And you live streamers, good morning to you. Now, last week I told you Sister Carol was going to be here. And as you can see, she's not. But it's not her fault. It is the fault of the storm that we had. My planes to Little Rock were canceled. And so I couldn't go there. So I thought I ought to come back here. And I didn't realize until I was on my way in on the train today that when I get here, you all would crucify me because I'm not Sister Carol. I should have stayed home. But never fear. She will be back with you 2 weeks from today. And so when I asked, I said, well, I'm here. I think I'll come in and do the class. And she said, oh, well, okay, I'm just trying to help. And then she says, but I know a lot more about Judas Iscariot than I did. So. She probably knew a fair amount about him before. So, you know, in this time leading up to Easter, we're going to be taking a look at some of the characters and the events that led up to the crucifixion of Jesus. You know, it happens so fast in Holy Week. You've got a week to do all this thinking of the story. And then Easter comes, and it's such a joyful time. So we're going to just kind of slow our way through it and look through some of these hard things. Because, you know, you wouldn't have an Easter if you didn't have a Good Friday. And we all have those Good Friday times in our lives. So thank God we can rejoice. But we also must acknowledge that the road to rejoicing is often paved with sorrow. And here is a central puzzling character in that drama. Today we're going to talk about Judas Iscariot. Iscariot, the son of Simon Iscariot, John tells us. But it's also true that there was a faction of people called the Sicarii. Iscariot, Sicarii. Well, maybe. And they were assassins. They were political assassins like the modern terrorists we see sometimes, people who would try to sow discontent and panic and fear among the people by killing people. They were terrorists. Was Judas Iscariot one of them? That movement does not appear in the records until long after the crucifixion. He dies about the same time Jesus dies in the 30s. And the Sicarii are a little later. They're in about the 50s and 60s, leading up to what happened in 70 AD when everything goes kaput for Israel and they all scatter to the four winds. So I don't think that Judas was a Sicarius, but you know, it's possible that someone named him Iscariot in the text to make us think of that they knew about the Sicarii, even if the people in the 30s didn't know about the Sicarii, and so they called him Judas the Assassin. It's possible. Or maybe he just was the son of a guy named Iscariot. And like Jesus says in the Bible, maybe that's the case. So he appears in all of them. It's pretty clear. Everybody, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, testify that Jesus was betrayed by one of his own and that it was Judas. Judas has become a name. You know, you call somebody a Judas today if he's a traitor, but actually it was a common name. He was not the only Judas. Judas Barsabbas was a Judas, and Judas Thomas was another Judas. So it was a common name, and it relates to the root for Jews. A Jewish person, Judas, is the root of that name. Let's take a look with your Bibles at two possible motives. What did Judas think he was doing? The simplest one is the one that Matthew and John go with. As you know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke always agree, well, not always, but often agree, so much so that they're called the synoptics. That means they see together. And John is often an outlier doing something else. Not here. Matthew and John agree about Judas's motives. Let's take a look at Matthew 26. Verse 14 to 16, Matthew 26, 14 to 16. And people who don't feel like looking in Matthew, go to John and look at John 12, because we're going to get to him before too long. What does Matthew think in verses 14 to 16, why did Judas do this? Somebody read. Who wants to read? Here comes our mic, and here's our mic reader. And this is a lady who knows how to use a mic.
Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I deliver him to you?" And they paid him 30 pieces of silver, and from that moment he sought an opportunity to betray him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where we're going to. Is that it?
I'm sorry?
What's the ending?
Oh, you're good. You're good. Okay. So, why? He wanted money. He was greedy. So that's what Matthew thinks. Let's take a look at what John thinks in chapter 12. Chapter 12 of John. Matthew and John aren't always talked about in the same breath, but they are here. John 12, verse 6. We begin with some things about Judas. Verse 6. Who will read? Let's start with 4, verse 4, not verse 6. Who wants to read? John 12, verse 4 and following. Here comes somebody. Right into the mic.
But one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. "Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages." He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it.
Yeah, so Judas used to be a thief. He was the keep for John. He was the keeper of the purse. And John says that he used to steal money from the purse. That's what he did. So this, he says this when the lady anoints his feet with costly perfume. And Judas says, "Well, don't do that. We should take that money and give it to the poor instead." And John tells us parenthetically, he doesn't care about the poor. He just wants to take that. He just wants that money because he was a thief. He used to keep the purse and steal money from it. So both Matthew and John are pretty sure that the motive is greed. What does Luke think? Let's see what Luke thinks about that. Let's look at Luke 22. He doesn't have a history of greed on the part of Judas. Luke 22, verses 3 to 6. Who wants to read? Who wants to read? Luke 22. Here comes somebody going to read.
Now, the festival of the unleavened bread, which is called the Passover, was near. The chief priests and the scribes were looking for a way to put Jesus to death, but they were afraid of the people. Then Satan entered into Judas and called Iscariot, who was one of the 12. He went away and conferred with the chief priests and officers of the temple police about how he might betray him to them. They were greatly pleased and agreed to give him money. So he consented and began to look for an opportunity to betray him to them, and no crowd was present.
So he wants to find an opportunity to betray him when there's not a crowd so that there will not be a riot. But Luke doesn't say that Judas was a thief forever, like John does. So John and Matthew say greed. Luke just says Satan. The reason he did it was that Satan entered into him. Let's go back to Matthew. We've got the betrayal. Now we are in the Last Supper in Matthew. Matthew 26, verses 23 and following. They are at the Last Supper, and it seems in Matthew to be a Seder, because they're doing things that you do in a Seder, like dipping bread in salt water. And I think you've had some Seders here, haven't you? You've done that, or maybe visited some friends who are Jewish. So one of the things you do is dip bread into salt water, symbolizing the tears of the people of Israel. And you eat that together. And so they're doing that in this feast. Let's take a look at Matthew 26, 23 and following. Who's going to read? Here comes somebody.
He answered, "The one who has dipped his hands into the bowl with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written for him. But woe to that one by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that one not to have been born." Judas, who betrayed him, said, "Surely not I, Rabbi. He replied, "You have said so."
It wasn't me, was it? Well, you said it. So it was he. And in the context of this Last Supper, which in Matthew, Mark, and Luke is what the Last Supper is a Seder. John has a different view of what the Last Supper is. The tears, the dipping of the bread into the tears is a significant act. The Seder meal is about deliverance and a lot of great things. But Judas is, and Satan enters into Judas when he's dipping the bread into tears. So that's significant. We would see that as, yes, that's very eloquent, that we're talking about something terrible. In Matthew 26, verses 23 and following, there's such ambivalence about it. This has to happen. But woe to you if you're the one by whom it happens. This is a thing that needs to happen, but the one who makes it happen is woe to him. Woe to him. What are we to think about? That's two different things. He's doing a necessary thing, but still he's a bad guy. We're not letting him off the hook because of the fact that it was necessary. Now we're going to close in on the Gospel of John, because a lot happens with relation to Judas in the Gospel of John, and it's interesting. In John 33, verse 27, Judas took the bread, it says, and at that moment, I'm in 13, verse 27, Satan entered into him. At the moment he took the bread, Satan entered into him. What happens to people in John's church when they take bread? Who enters into them? Is it Satan? No. Who enters into somebody in the first century when they're in a church and they're taking the Eucharist? Jesus, yeah. But John takes bread at this Last Supper, and who enters into him? Satan. So a person reading this in the first century is going to say, that's very nice, this little flip that this writer is doing. And don't think they wouldn't notice that. They loved things like that. They loved symbolism. I love things like that, which is why I'm telling you. So he takes the bread, and Satan enters into him. Further on in chapter 13, we have the mythology about Judas being a thief. After receiving the bread, he immediately went out, and it was night. So that by now, he's gone to get the chief priests and everybody. Let's continue in chapter 13, verses 47 and following. We're still in John. Who will read verses 47 and following of chapter 13 in the Gospel of John? We are now in the garden. 47 and following.
Chapter 16.
Let's take a look. You know, can't walk and chew gum at the same time, I guess. Yeah, it's 18, I'm sorry. Notice that it's 18. And it's not 47 either. It is verse 3. Let's go to verse 2. We're not naming the garden here. It's not named Gethsemane here. It's just a garden. Chapter 18. Verses 2 and following. comes somebody.
Now Judas, who was, excuse me, now Judas, who was, who betrayed him, also knew the place, because Jesus often met there with his disciples. So Judas brought a detachment of soldiers together with police from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. Then Jesus, knowing all that was to happen to him, came forward and asked them, "Whom are you looking for?" They answered, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus replied, "I am he." Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, "I am he," they stepped back and fell to the ground. Again he asked them, "Whom are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you are looking for me, let these men go." This was to fulfill the word that he had spoken, "I did not lose a single one of them, one of those whom you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's slave and cut off his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. And Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword back into its sheath. I am not to drink the cup that the Father has given me."
Am I not to drink that cup? So again, this is necessary. We can't fight this, he says. Who draws his swords? Peter. Peter is the one who is very impulsive, always does the impulsive thing, and he wants to defend Jesus in the normal way, and Jesus will not allow it. Something is missing from John, something famous in this account. Does not happen here. What is it? The kiss. No kiss. No Judas kiss. So let's see if we can find the Judas kiss. It's not in John. Let's take a look at Luke 22. See, now I'm scared myself. Write all these things down, and that's your first mistake. Let's take a look at verse 22. That's where our 47 is. Who will read? I'll read. Oh, got it? Okay, good.
While he, how long do you want to go? The whole 40, the whole till 53?
Luke 22, verses 47 and following.
Okay. While he was still speaking, suddenly a crowd came, and the one called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus said to him, "Judas, is it with a kiss that you are betraying the Son of Man?" When those who were around him saw what was coming, they asked, "Lord, should we strike with the sword?" Then one of them struck the slave of the high priest and cut off his right ear. But Jesus said, "No more of this." And he touched his ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple police and the elders who had come for him, "Have you come out with swords and clubs as if I were a bandit? When I was with you day after day in the temple, you did not lay hands on me. But this is your hour and the power of darkness."
Yep, that's what happens. Now, there's a difference between Luke and John here. In John, who comes there? A bunch of people come. So here they are, and it says, Judas brought, and this is verse 3 of 18, you don't need to turn there. Judas brought a detachment of soldiers together with police from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they came there with lanterns and torches. And something else, weapons. He comes, Judas, with soldiers. In Luke, who does he come with in those verses? Verses 47 and following of chapter 22. He's got a crowd. Yeah. Israel is an occupied country. Who has soldiers in Israel? No Jew has soldiers, that's for sure. There are temple police, but those aren't soldiers. If you're coming with soldiers, who are those soldiers?
Romans.
They're Romans, yeah. So Judas is either marshaling, or John wants us to think that he is marshaling the power of Rome to work through the Jewish jealousy of Jesus and bring him down. One thing we know about Rome is that they were reluctant to bother people as long as they kept their heads down. They'd let you kind of do what you needed to do as long as you didn't bother them and as long as you didn't raise a ruckus. They sense a ruckus raising. So the presence of soldiers in John suggests that at least John thinks that the Romans are into this as well. And this, I think, is important for us because centuries of anti-Semitism have made Holy Week and especially Good Friday the scariest time of the year for Jews everywhere. Jewish people in many European countries, they'd just stay inside on Good Friday because it was dangerous out there. There might be roving gangs of Christian drunks who'd string them up because they did what? What did they say they did? They killed Christ, that the Jews killed Christ. Well, the Jews really weren't able to kill anybody. That's not the case. And they certainly didn't crucify people. That was Roman form of execution. So John brings the Romans into this, and I think that we can be glad about that. Now, we don't always look to John to get rid of anti-Semitism, do we? Because it's in John that we often hear about the Jews doing this and the Jews doing that. But they're all Jews. So when John talks about the Jews doing this, he's not talking from the outside. He's talking, the Jewish authorities might be a better way for him to have phrased it. But, you know, he didn't do that, but that's how it is. So greed, possible motive. There are other motives that were possible. And you might have read the book, The Last Temptation of Christ by Nikos Kazantzakis, or seen the movie, Martin Scorsese's movie of it, which you'll recall was very controversial when it came out. Remember that? People were picketing it, and they didn't want people to show it, and it was quite a remarkable film, but an even more remarkable book. But in that was a theme that didn't appear there for the first time, the idea that Judas was working with Jesus about the crucifixion, that this was going to be, that Jesus knew this had to happen, and he enlisted Judas to help him do this. And that's what the betrayal was. Well, The Last Temptation of Christ is a work of fiction, so I don't think we can, you know, we don't have to worry too much about it, but it introduces an interesting idea, and it wasn't the first time that came up. In one of the Gnostic Gospels, a Gnostic is a word that actually scholars don't use anymore because they've decided it's pejorative, but Gospels that were written alongside Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that didn't get into the canon that we now know as the Bible, and there were many of them, as you know. There was one called the Gospel of Judas, and it was written, toward the end of the first century. It was known and condemned sometime in the second century, so we know it had been around that long anyway. So it's an old, old book. It was rediscovered in modern times just in the 1970s. And then it was not published until 2006. So Scorsese was not dependent on this gospel for his idea, nor was Nikos Kazantzakis the writer of the book, The Last Temptation of Christ. But it is an old idea that Judas and Jesus were in this together, and that Judas was a reluctant, loving collaborator with Jesus in what would, you know, today we would call suicide by cop, you know? What do you think about that? What do you think about that? What if Judas, the arch betrayer, turns out to have been an important part of the story. Who has a thought about that? Here comes a thought, and here comes the mic. Oh my goodness, look at that mic go. The mic is redirected.
I have no idea where I'm walking. Crystal. Thank you.
Hi. My understanding is that the way that Judas died was that he fell and his bowels opened.
Well, there are two accounts, and we are going to get to that.
I don't picture that as being a collaborator's death.
It seems, you don't picture?
I don't picture that as being a collaborator with Jesus' death.
No, that's correct. There are two accounts of Judas' death. We'll get to that in a minute. I suppose if you wanted to pursue that he was a collaborator idea, you could say, he was a collaborator, and then when he saw that, he wished he hadn't and killed himself. That's possible. That's possible. What do you think?
It's troubling because there's a part of me that thinks, especially in the scriptures,
a little louder.
That I think, especially in the scriptures we just read, that this is as it had to pass. This is so. Mm-hmm. In a way, one of the 12 needed to betray Jesus, mm-hmm. and for this redemption plan to launch. Mm-hmm. And so I think what's troubled me whenever I consider this story, and I'm so glad we are.
It hurts.
It does hurt to think what, in the grand scheme of redemption, what is my role?
Well,
what was Judas's role?
Well, when they're at the Last Supper and Jesus says, one of you is going to betray me, what do they all say?
Not I.
Is it I, Lord? So as some of them say, not I. Some of them are saying, is it I? Is it I? How frightening. One of you is going to betray me. What? You know, this is a band of brothers. These are people who love each other. One of you is going to turn on me. That would be a horrible thing.
Peter does.
Yeah, and Peter's with an arch. No, I won't do it. I'm the only one you can depend on, you and me, right? And he doesn't betray him, but he denies him. So why are we, remember that I've talked about this before. There's a term in scholarship called the criterion of embarrassment. The idea that if something is told in scripture that makes us not look good, it might be true, because otherwise why would we say it? The criterion of embarrassment. Isn't that a good one? I love that. The criterion of embarrassment. If I'm telling you this and it makes me look bad, and I know it, it must be true, or I'd rather not. So the betrayal of Jesus by one of his own kind of meets the criterion of embarrassment. Do we have to have a betrayer among the disciples for him to get killed? No. Yeah, they can kill him anytime they want to, and who knows, maybe they did. But we have this story, and it is universal, though it's told differently by all four. And also in other Gospels, it is told by everybody that not just he died, and wasn't that a shame, but he was betrayed by people who were close to him. And one of the things that what the criterion of embarrassment always does for us, which is something we need, is it reminds us to suspect ourselves. You should suspect yourself, which is not the same thing as saying, oh, you should hate yourself, or you should never credit any of your gifts. No. You should admire in yourself the things that are good. But you should always suspect yourself, because sometimes the things you think are colored by a lot of stuff. For instance, if you run a fossil fuel company, it's in your interest to think that global warming is not real. You make money if you think that. So, of course, you think that. I mean, you might not think it, but it's in your interest to think it. So if somebody's going to hand you a check for having an opinion, you're likely to have that opinion, or at least it's going to seem like something worth considering to you. So what the criterion of embarrassment helps us do, as uncomfortable as it is to suspect ourselves. Why do I think the things I think? Well, you might say, because they're self-evident. Any fool would think that. Well, that's one answer. But it could be that the ancient lawyer's question applies. I think we've talked about that in here. Qui bono? Who benefits from this? The one who benefits may, through his benefit, be colored in his opinion. He may not, but he may. And so when I talk about suspecting myself, I don't mean, oh, everything you think has got to be wrong because you're thinking it. No, no, no. Only I'm going to ask myself questions like, qui bono? Who benefits? What is your opinion about this? If I say I'm a white person and I say, well, you know, there's no bigotry in the world. I'm doing fine. And I am. But is that, have we said everything we need to say if we've said a white person is doing fine? We're glad that person's doing fine. Everybody ought to be doing fine. So the criterion of embarrassment and the suspicion of the self is always divisive, and it makes people mad. And but it's okay if people get mad, and it's all right if something you say distresses somebody else. It's not all right if you descend to name calling and stupid stuff, like a child. But it's all right to, you know, take a stand that is in disagreement with someone else and be prepared to defend it. And also be prepared to suspect yourself. One of the difficulties with politicians today is that they so resist the suspicion of the self. They, no, I'm perfectly fine. I am a true American, and I'm only animated by love of country. You are animated by love of country, but you may also be animated by other things. And it would be worth at least to ask of ourselves. Judas dies. How did he die? There are two ways. The oldest one is that he hung himself. When he realized what he was done, he was full of contrition. And he tried to give the money back, and they wouldn't take it. So he threw it on the ground, and he went out and hung himself. And one of the trees, there are many trees vying for the honor of the one upon which he hung himself, but the one that I like is it's a tree we have here. It's a beautiful tree. It's the redbud tree here, also called the Judas tree. It's going to bloom here in May. So it's not the earliest of the blooming trees that we have, and it's the one whose branches are lined with a sort of a deep pink. They don't like hang from it. The branches appear to be lined with it. So go to the park and take a look. Look for the Judas trees. Look for the redbud trees. They're so beautiful. They're just lovely. They often will be on the edge of a forest, I guess because they need a little more light than some of the other trees that don't bloom. But that's the tree that Judas hung himself on, we hear. So that's one way he died. Another is he took these 30 pieces of silver and he bought a field and he fell down in the field, it says. One witness says he threw himself down and he exploded and his bowels burst out, and so they called that field the Field of Blood thenceforward, and it was used as the Potter's Field, a place to bury paupers in the future. So two accounts for Judas's death. There were other accounts in other Gospels. You can imagine how important and colorful a figure Judas was for later writers because it's a dramatic story. And everybody likes dramatic stories. So one of them, I remember, said that Judas, he walked around really wretched all his days, lived to be old, I guess, and he swelled up so that he could not fit into a chariot. And he was walking through a gate, and a chariot crushed him against the gate and popped him open. Well, you know, that's a story about the death of Judas. Another one, and this is a Muslim writer. He said, Judas lied to the Jews in order to defend Jesus, assumed his identity, looked like him, and was crucified in his place. Meanwhile, because the Muslims could not believe, like many in the first century could not believe, that God could die, that can't be. So they do not believe that Jesus was God, and they don't believe that he died. They believe that while Judas was down here getting crucified because he suddenly looked just like Jesus, Jesus had been taken up into heaven and was in the third heaven, kind of watching what was going on. And when it came to his attention, this is in this tale, that this had happened to Judas, he said, oh, came back down, went into the tomb, rose from the dead, and completed the story. Well, you know, that didn't get a lot of traction. It's a Muslim tale, not ours, and, you know, so the Muslims didn't pay a ton of attention to it either, I think. But it's so interesting that people would want to embroider this man's life and death. Here's another one. It says that this was a ballad in English. It's one of the oldest English ballads there ever was. Said that Jesus, this is while he's before the crucifixion, gives Judas 30 pieces of silver to buy some food. Judas is waylaid by his own sister while he's on his way to buy the food. A woman. The new Eve, maybe. He's waylaid by his sister, who lulls him to sleep, steals the money. When Judas wakes up and sees the money's missing, he doesn't want to confess how dumb he was to fall asleep with all that money. So he sells Jesus to the Romans for the same amount of money. Well, all I can tell you, it was a popular ballad in the 13th century AD. Yes, it's a long time ago, but it's not 2,000 years ago. It's 700 years ago. And it just goes to show you how willing people are, Christians, everybody is, to take a tale and tell tales about it. You know, there's no television, there's no radio, there's, you know, stuff like that. People can't read. They have to tell stories. So they, you know, you want a story, I'll tell you a better story. And that's kind of what they did. And we have some record of those, and this is one of those. And, of course, you can retain them by singing them. So clearly they sang them to each other because we still have the text, and we still, it's obviously not a popular song today, but it is still known that it existed. So you are Judas, and you're one of the 12. He's sometimes depicted with red hair. Sometimes Europeans were suspicious of people with red hair. They thought they had power. They do. Just ask them. We have power. And so Judas is sometimes depicted with red hair. He is often depicted with a dark halo. Everybody has, you know, bright halos, and his is dark. Or no halo. So you'll be seeing, you know, all the people with halos. The guy without a halo is Judas. And or the one with the dark halo, with the halo with no light, is Judas. So you're Judas, and you're with your band of brothers and sisters. We don't mention the sisters much, but they were there. What do you think? And you live streamers, you must have thought, what on earth would get into a person to make him do that? What would be the makeup of a person who could do that? Simple answer, he's just a bad guy. It's John's answer. Oh, yeah, he's been a thief his whole life. He used to steal money from us all the time. That's an answer. What do you think?
This is not my theory, but one theory you haven't mentioned is that he hoped by doing this that he would push Jesus into being the kind of Messiah that many of the Jews wanted and hoped for. Someone who would rise up and liberate them from the Romans. That's why he was so grievously, grievously sorry.
It didn't happen.
When it didn't happen and he realized that he had been responsible for
that
his crucifixion.
That he hoped that, you know, by pushing this, he would bring about the insurrection that he wanted, that maybe they all wanted. Who knows what they wanted. But and it didn't happen. And that in horror, You know, not only did I do this, but I sacrificed my friend to do this and failed. And that's what a terrorist, you know, when Timothy McVeigh bombed the Murrah building, remember? He thought that this would make us all rise up against our government. Why he thought that, I don't know. Hung out with the wrong people, but that is what he thought. And so under this model, Judas would be like that too. He thought that it would push people to rise up. Yes, Jim.
In the first temptation of Christ, at the end of it, it said that the devil left for a more opportune time.
Yes.
And maybe this is that opportune time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Marilyn. We're going to get you the mic.
There would be no story if Judas didn't turn in Christ. And the other thing that I was questioning...
I want you to speak right into the mic.
The other thing I was questioning is this morning they did Ben-Hur, the movie.
Oh, yeah.
The most horrible way of dying is seeing the crucifixion depicted on film, what the crucifixion was and what happened to Christ. My question to you is, how and why did they ever come up with this horrible way of killing?
With the method of execution, yeah. Its purpose, of course, is not just to kill people. You can just stab them and kill them. But it's to humiliate them. The purpose of crucifixion was public. It was a public way. You want to kill somebody, you just assassinate him. But what if you want is to deter? You're going to kill him in a very visible public way, in a way that is sufficiently horrible and protracted that anybody who sees it is going to think twice about stepping out of line. And then, of course, they ordinarily, to take Jesus' body down and bury it, that was unusual. That doesn't usually happen. Just leave him up there and let the crows eat him and let the people walk by and see it. And, you know, let his family have to walk by and see what happened. Humiliation. Also, in a society that is extremely modest, as societies in the Middle East are today. People don't go around naked in Middle Eastern society today. And one of the things that troubles them about American culture is our scanty attire, you know, that we go around, you know, uncovered. And this is troublesome to them because they're extremely modest. And so crucifixion, you know, we have always the loincloth around Jesus, but no, he was almost certainly crucified in the nude. And nudity in public is a terrible thing in those cultures, just a shameful thing. I got one more.
I can relate to the desperation. That's what I think would drive in my own life.
If it were you.
Where I'm taking matters into my own hands. Mm-hmm. I'm working in the circumstances I can see, and I'm going to do something.
Yeah.
And in that... And then also relating to the wanting to fix it and not being able to, it's grievous.
Yeah, yeah. I can understand that. I can't understand that. You know, maybe. So what I want us to think, leave thinking, is you can just think, you know, Judas is a terrible guy, and maybe he is a terrible guy. But what must it have been to be him? What other possibilities are there? Was what he did unforgivable? All of us are better than the worst thing we've ever done, aren't we? Would you want to be judged for everything by the worst thing you've ever done? I would not. We're also not as good as the best thing we've ever done, by the way. But but all of us are better than the worst thing we've ever done. Even Judas, in traditional monastic theology, all of this is called the felix culpa, the happy fall. The fall of Adam and Eve is called the felix culpa, the happy guilt. And this had to happen in order for us to be redeemed by Jesus. And so Judas's action would be a felix culpa. And you know, what do we call the Friday on which Jesus died? Good Friday. Didn't you used to wonder about that when you were a kid? What's good about it? Were you there When they crucified my Lord, were you there when they crucified my Lord? Sometimes it causes me to tremble. Were you there when they crucified my Lord? Thank you all. God bless you all. And Sister Carol, in 2 weeks, be patient.